You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 25th to the 31st of July 2013. My name is Chris Parr and this week I'll be discussing some of the best articles in this week's magazine with writers Matthew Rice and Elizabeth Gibney and news editor Simon Baker. We'll be covering concerns that a new Ofsted inspection system is leading to a downgrading of university-based initial teacher training provision, calls for changes at the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council will also be covered, and we'll hear a bit more about the inaugural Times Higher Education Best University Workplace Survey. Finally, Matthew will report back to us on what he learned at the Performing Porn Conference, which took place in London earlier this month. So quite an array of things to discuss. Simon, the lead news story this week, though, was by John Morgan. He's not here, so you can tackle this one. University-based teacher training. It's a bit of a hot potato at the minute.
Well, yeah, I suppose the first initial reaction might be teacher training. Oh, right, yeah, okay, what's that to do with higher education? But, of course, it's more to do with schools. But the important point here is that teacher training is a huge, hugely important part of university provision, actually, especially for quite a few post-92 universities who have basically incorporated what were quite large teacher training colleges. So you've got some quite important universities in some cities that provide a lot of teacher training. And what's happened under the coalition government is there's a drive by Michael Gove to move teacher training more to schools-based training, effectively, so that I think he wants more teachers to be trained effectively, I suppose, like apprentices on the, you know, in the environment that they're actually going to end up working in.
That sounds like a reasonable idea, but I suppose it does mean that universities then start to miss out on students, on people to teach.
Well, because a lot of PGCEs at the moment have done where you study in the university, you obviously still have a school placement, but I mean the course is actually mainly based at university. But the reason why this is controversial is Ofsted, which is supposed to be an independent, obviously, body in inspecting schools and inspecting provision of teacher training, it's changed its framework when it for inspections of teacher training providers. So that's happened in the last year, and at the same time, there's been this drive to more schools-based provision. Well, since the framework has changed and there's been new inspections, it's actually emerged that the university providers are getting lower marks for their Ofsted inspections.
Less of them
are getting outstanding and compared with before. And although the figures are kind of, you know, we're only talking about a small number of inspections so far, that seems to be the case. Yeah, and then on the other hand, the schools-based provision, you know, they seem to be getting better marks. Now, you know, on the face of it, that looks a little bit fishy. And
there's a political drive to have more schools-based provision, and this is they seem to be the ones that are getting the better marks. We should point out that Ofsted, obviously.
Ofsted deny that there's any, you know, because the accusation that Ofsted is being politicised in some way is absolutely, you know, it's quite a serious allegation, you know, and it's supposed to be independent of government. But the idea that there is this kind of whether this is a coincidence or not, you know, and whether there is some kind of influence going on here, you know, makes it quite a serious story. And like as you say, Ofsted do actually refute any suggestion that they've been influenced in any way by this change of policy.
Now, it's an interesting article. There's a vice chancellor who speaks to us off the record there, expressing some of those concerns.
I mean, I should point out that the reason why it's very important is that if these universities start being downgraded in their Ofsted inspections, they'll lose places. So the places will move to the teacher training or move to the schools-based provision.
You have to get outstanding, don't you, to be guaranteed continuation of that programme.
Basically. Otherwise, you risk losing places. Places mean money for universities. And if you look at the income for some post-92 universities and how much they get from teacher training, it's quite substantial.
Absolutely. It seems like outstanding is something that's quite difficult to achieve now as well under the new system.
Well, yeah, I mean, the same has happened in schools as well. I mean, they've whenever the government's come along and said, actually, we want a tougher inspection regime, the framework changes. Suddenly a school that is actually judged as being outstanding is suddenly just satisfactory. You know, and that's sometimes due to the framework. So this argument is has been rumbling on for a few years.
Mm, that's satisfactory in Ofsted speak, of course. Not satisfactory as in doing the job that it's there to do. Satisfactory as in not good enough would be how a lot of people interpret that.
That's how a lot of schools see it. If they get satisfactory, they sort of see that as a failure, don't they, sometimes?
Indeed, indeed. That's the lead story. Do have a read to get more detail on that. Lizzie, this week you've got some coverage of a critical report on how the EPSRC, the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council, operates. It's having a bit of a tough time at the moment. What's happening?
Yeah, well, if you cast your mind back about a year, if you remember, we had this great image of a horse-drawn hearse going down from the Houses of Parliament to Downing Street, and that was supposedly the death of science, the death of British science. And that was in response to these changes that the EPSRC has been making. And a lot of people out there within the community felt that the idea of having this programme shaping capabilities that the council introduced, which was designed to shrink and grow different areas of research in the physical sciences in the UK, as well as according to their excellence, according to their national importance. And there's a huge uproar about this. There was a lot of criticism about the fact that they didn't properly consult some of the people they were supposed to. They said that we spoke to the Institute of Physics. The Institute of Physics put out a press release saying we weren't consulted. You know, we were briefed, we weren't certainly not consulted. So this rumbled on. And last year, Paul Golby was brought in as chairman, and he instigated a couple of reviews at the council, and these are just starting to come out now. So the review, which was, you know, it's quite high profile, it was run by the head of the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council in Canada, the former head. And it had many of the same criticisms, although in a lot more friendly language that was probably more amenable to the council. But so a lot of people I spoke to who were very critical last year were just reacting to the results of this review. And they essentially agree and they're pleased that they've been listened to in this way, but they are a little bit sceptical, I would say, that they will have any big impact on the back of this. Paul Golby said that they will respond, and they're very, you know, happy to have received this kind of constructive criticism. But what changes?
What's the action
we'll
going
to
be?
To
yeah. Talk about talk and reviews about having more reviews. It always
well, I mean,
a problem,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it says the language of the report is things like we want, you know, two-way engagement both before and after decision making. But I'm pretty sure in theory that should have been happening already. So what physically you change, what actually is different about the way the council works, will be interesting how they go about actually interpreting the recommendations.
Mm-hmm. No, it's good that the review has come out. I guess research councils often, you know, how they operate, the ins and outs. It's not always in the public eye, is it?
Well, that's it. And that was the point. Is transparency is incredibly important. That was one of the recommendations. And another feeling that I got from speaking to people was that having Paul Golby there was definitely going in the right direction for the council. That he did seem to be trying to get, you know, have a new clean slate. And hopefully there will be changes. I think they realise that actually you can't have that level of discord with your own community, that will cause a lot of problems. And in fact, it still obviously carries on. We've got a little box at the bottom which is talking about a long-standing member of the peer review college who's resigned because of a stream of issues that he's seen building up over the years. But the last straw was being asked to do an online training course on peer review, and you know. He said, I'm sure I could learn an awful lot from my colleagues who are very experienced in peer review as well, but I'm not sure a generic kind of multiple choice training course is going to do a lot. So
I suppose it goes to the core kind of issue that crops up time and again with research councils, and that is, you know, are the research councils themselves trying to push the agendas and push where research should be going, or is that up to the academics in what they submit? You know, it seems to be there's always this... You know, has there been some sort of unfair or undue influence being put across by administrators, really, rather than researchers?
That's the criticism, is that it is people who don't really know about science who are making these decisions. And I mean, I don't know if that's completely fair, because obviously they do a lot of work in looking at the administration of it. But
yeah, they do understand the research they're looking at, I would have thought, to a certain extent.
Otherwise,
they wouldn't
so.
Be there.
You would think so. But the councils have kind of admitted that that's what they're doing, in the sense that they talk about moving from a funder to being a sponsor, and that might sound like jargon, but essentially what they're saying is they're moving from just giving out money and saying use it for what you will to saying we're a sponsor, we want certain things to come out of what we fund, and therefore they feel they do have some kind of a role at least in shaping what goes on.
Again, it sounds like the kind of thing that might have been happening anyway in a perfect world, but it's certainly encouraging. The main news there this week, of course, is dominated by the royal baby. I received a press release from a well-known bookmaker's offering odds on which university the young prince will attend. That's in our week in HE this week. You can have a look. If you're interested, St Andrews was the favourite, 2-1, Oxbridge 3-1, the aptly named King's College 14-1. However, one story that did manage to make it into the papers despite that blanket coverage was news that UK households will soon have internet pornography blocked by their service provider unless they choose to receive it. Matthew, this brings us to an event you attended earlier this month where pornography was very much on the agenda, I guess. Where was this? What was happening?
Well, this is a space used by performance artists in the East End of London, and it brought together academics, some of whom are also performance artists themselves, the kind of wilder end of performance art, but also strippers and cam girls and even a professional submissive. So there were quite a range of rather extraordinary people, at least for someone who's led as sheltered a life as I have.
I don't believe it for a second. This was the Performing Porn Conference, it was called. I mean, what does your story tackle? I mean, I guess there's some quite serious issues on the agenda. It wasn't just light-hearted. It wasn't smutty. This was a serious conference.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are serious issues. I mean, there are questions with pornography everywhere. What does that mean? Does it just make it boring? Is it pernicious? Or are there opportunities for individuals to kind of create their own erotica, which is perhaps, you know, more interesting than big commercial companies would be handing out? There's also the whole issue of, you know, how much pornography, or most pornography, is not only misogynist but violently misogynist, and whether there are kind of radically feminist ways of, as it were, undermining the genre with from within. So there's no doubt that there are important moral and social issues there. I mean, it was nonetheless a pretty extraordinary event. I mean, there was a demonstration of Japanese rope bondage, which was indeed very tender and consensual and female friendly and in no way objectionable. And then there was a video where, I don't know quite how to describe it, a woman very much entangled with an octopus.
That's one way to describe it.
And so it went on. And I think the other thing is that there is the boundaries between the kind of extreme forms of performance art and pornography are quite interesting. Mm. And some of the people there, being academics, they were very reflective and reflecting on these issues. But also they are out there on the edge of doing some pretty subversive and disturbing and intriguing stuff. Mm.
Given that this is such an important part and issue, as we were saying, it's in the news at the moment, it's an important part of our society today, do you think there is enough academic study of it? It just strikes me as, the other week we were talking about gang culture and how it's a very nasty part of our society, and so for that reason perhaps it isn't studied very much, or it's a very difficult thing to study. This is almost in that way as well. It must be very, I can imagine it being hard to get funding for studies of porn, but actually we need people to be doing those kind of things.
Yeah, so well, I think that's true, and there was this there's this academic journal of porn studies which is
it's
underway,
quite controversial,
and it's proved very controversial because some people who take the line basically that pornography is pretty much totally a bad thing, misogynistic and reductive and cruel and so on, and they argue that some of the people on the editorial board are kind of involved in the porn industry, so will it be critical enough? So that has been a big issue, and I think it is a debate, and there aren't that many researchers who are kind of openly studying pornography, I suppose, and it's the kind of thing that the tabloid press tend to make fun of if someone gets appointed to a job with pornography in the title.
So it's probably a problem of language a lot of the time, isn't it? Because, you know, the word, it depends how you define the word, and so therefore that it follows from that whether what you're describing is something that's, what line you're going to take politically, I guess, and that's often the problem, I would have thought. And that's the problem with that journal. It's used that word, and some people see the word as meaning one thing and other people might not see it the same way. So
yes, I mean, I think this there was some pretty edgy stuff at this conference. There was also some very, very serious, very theoretical, very analytical material presented as well, which made it all the more interesting to have different perspectives.
Yeah, no, you can read that online now. Also, I know you did a story on that journal a couple of months back. You can search for that on the site as well if you want to read a bit more about that particular debate. Before we go, I should flag up one or two things. Our first ever Best University Workplace Survey is now live on our website. We're trying to find out which institutions are performing well and in which areas they're doing so. We want to hear your experiences. I won't say much more than that. It's a quick survey. You'll see a logo on our homepage. Do pop along if you've got time. The cover feature this week looks at five academics or five scholars looking back on their time at university over the last seven decades. We've got, let me just take a look here, Mary Warnock, who's a philosopher and crossbench peer. She went to university at Oxford in 1942, recalling her experiences. Christopher Bigsby, who is Professor of American Studies and Director of the Arthur Miller Centre at the University of East Anglia. He was at university in 1959, right up to someone who graduated this year, recommending her brother, I think it is, on whether the £9,000 fees are worth it. A really interesting sort of snapshot of the of what university's been like over the last seven decades or so from a lot of different perspectives, so well worth checking that out. But if you do and you want to talk about it, you can comment on our website. That's timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, even on Google+. So there's no excuse not to join the conversation. Do get in touch. But until next week, that's the end of the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.